The Agent. On October 12, 2000, in the deepwater port of Aden, Yemen, the USS Cole, a guided missile destroyer weighing 8,300 tons, was docked at a fueling buoy. The Cole, which cost $1 billion to build, was one of the most survivable ships in the U.S. Navy, with 70 tons of armor, a hull that could withstand an explosion of 51,000 pounds per square inch, and stealth technology designed to make the ship less visible to radar. As the Cole filled its tank, a fiberglass fishing boat containing plastic explosives approached. Two men brought the skiff to a halt amidships, smiled and waved, then stood at attention. The symbolism of this moment was exactly what Osama bin Laden had hoped for when he approved a plan to attack an American naval vessel. "The destroyer represented the West," bin Laden said later. "The small boat represented Muhammad." The shockwave from the blast shattered windows on shore. 2 miles away, people thought there had been an earthquake. The blast opened a hole 40 feet by 40 feet in the port side of the ship, tearing apart sailors below decks who were waiting for lunch. The fireball that rose from the waterline swallowed a sailor who had leaned over the rail to see what the men in the skiff were up to. 17 sailors perished, and 39 were wounded. Some had to swim through the blast hole to escape the flames. The great man of war looked like a gutted animal. Shortly after the attack, Special Agent Ali Soufan, a 29-year-old Lebanese-American, was driving across the Brooklyn Bridge when he received a page from the New York office of the FBI. He was told to report to work at once. At the time, Soufan was the only FBI agent in the city who spoke Arabic, and one of only 8 in the country. He had joined the New York office in the fall of 1997. The following February, when bin Laden issued a fatwa declaring war on America, Soufan wrote a trenchant report on Islamic fundamentalism that caught the attention of John O'Neill, then head of the New York office of the FBI's National Security Division. Soufan's language skills, his relentlessness, and his roots in the Middle East made him invaluable in helping the FBI understand Al-Qaeda, an organization that few Americans were even aware of before the 1998 bombings of the American embassies in East Africa. Despite Soufan's youth and his relatively short tenure, O'Neill placed him in charge of the Cole investigation. As it turned out, Soufan became America's best chance to stop the attacks of September 11th. Soufan speaks rapidly, and there is still a hint of Lebanon in his voice. He has an open face and an engaging smile, although there are circles under his eyes from too many long nights. He is a Muslim, but he doesn't follow any particular school of Islam. Instead, he is drawn to mystical thought, especially that of Khalil Gibran, the Lebanese-American poet. He is also fascinated by the Kabbalah, because it appeared at a time when the political environment for the Jews was so harsh that they used this philosophy to escape their anguish. When he wants to relax, he watches reruns of Seinfeld. He's seen every episode 3 or 4 times, or Bugs Bunny cartoons. One of his favorite writers is Karen Armstrong, whose biographies of Muhammad and the Buddha knit together history and religion in a way that makes sense to him. Soufan grew up in Lebanon during the calamitous civil war, when cities were destroyed and terrorists were empowered by lawlessness and chaos. His father was a journalist in Beirut, and as a child, Ali helped at the business magazine his father produced, often carrying galleys to the print shop. In 1987, when Sufan was 16, the family moved to the United States. Sufan's most vivid initial impression of his adopted country was that it was safe. "Also, it allowed me to dream," he said. In return, America embraced Sufan. He never suffered from prejudice because he was Muslim or an Arab. His experience was completely opposite to that of the alienated Muslims in the West who had turned to Islamism as a way of finding an identity. He won many academic awards in high school, then attended Mansfield University in central Pennsylvania, where he was elected president of the student government. In 1997, he received a master's degree in international relations from Villanova University, outside Philadelphia. He planned to continue his studies in a PhD program at Cambridge University, but he had developed a fascination with the U.S. Constitution, in particular with its guarantees of freedom of speech, religion, and assembly, and the right to a speedy trial. And like many naturalized citizens, he had a feeling of indebtedness for the new life he had been given. "People who are born into the system may take it for granted," he said. "You don't know how important these rights are if you haven't lived in a country where you can be arrested or killed and not even know why." Although he was poised for an academic career, he decided, almost as a joke, to send his resume to the FBI. He thought it was inconceivable that the Bureau would hire someone with his background, but he was intrigued by the mystique, and obviously something inside him longed to be saved from the classroom. In July 1997, as he was packing to go to Cambridge, a letter arrived instructing him to report to the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, in 2 weeks. Upon graduation, Sufan went to the New York Bureau. He was soon assigned to the I-40 squad, which concentrated mainly on the Islamist paramilitary group Hamas. But in 1998, on the day after the East African Embassy bombings, O'Neill drafted him into I-49, which had become the lead unit in the FBI's investigation of Al-Qaeda. O'Neill could be brutal, not only to those under him, but to superiors who he felt were not fully committed to an investigation. Sufan proved to be a tireless ally, willing to work nights and holidays. The fact that a novice like Sufan had direct access to O'Neill aroused some resentment among the other agents, but the Bureau had nobody else with his skills and dedication. Yemen was filled with active Al-Qaeda cells and with sympathizers at very high levels of government. On television, Yemeni politicians called for jihad against America. When the advance team of agents landed in Aden the day after the attack, Sufan looked out at a detachment of the Yemen Special Forces who wore yellow uniforms with old Russian helmets. Each soldier was aiming an AK-47 at the U.S. plane. A jittery 12-man hostage rescue team, which had been sent along to protect the FBI agents, responded by brandishing their M4s and handguns. Sufan realized that everyone might die on the tarmac if he didn't do something quickly. He opened the plane's door. One Yemeni soldier was holding a walkie-talkie. Sufan walked directly toward him, carrying a bottle of water, as the guns followed him. It was 110 degrees outside. "You look thirsty," Sufan said in Arabic to the officer with the walkie-talkie. He handed him the bottle. "Is it American water?" the officer asked. Sufan assured him that it was, adding that he had American water for the other soldiers as well. The Yemenis considered the water such a precious commodity that some would not drink it. With this simple act of friendship, the soldiers lowered their weapons. Sufan divided the agents on the ground into four teams. The first three were responsible for forensics, intelligence, and security. The last was devoted to exchanging information with Yemeni authorities. Just getting permission from the Yemeni government to go to the crime scene, the wounded warship in the Aden Harbor, required lengthy negotiations with hostile officials. Security was a great concern, considering that automatic weapons were ubiquitous in the country, and Barbara Bodine, the American ambassador, refused to allow the agents to carry heavy arms for fear of offending the Yemeni authorities. When Soufan and the investigators visited the ship, clumps of flesh were strewn below decks, amid the tangled mass of wire and metal. FBI divers, hoping to make DNA identifications of the victims and the bombers, netted body parts floating in the waters around the ship. Looking through the huge blast hole, Soufan could see the mountainous ancient city of Aden rising above the curved harbor like a classical amphitheater. He figured that somewhere in the city, a camera had been set up to record the explosion, since terrorists regularly documented their work. Although the bombers were likely dead, a cameraman might still be at large. When O'Neill finally arrived in Aden with the rest of the FBI investigators, he was puzzled, as he disembarked, to see the Yemeni soldiers saluting. "I told them you were a general," Soufan explained to him. Yemen is a status-conscious society, and because Soufan had promoted O'Neill to general, his counterpart was General Ghalib Kamish, the head of Yemeni intelligence. Every night, when the Yemeni authorities did business, Soufan and O'Neill spent hours pushing for access to witnesses, evidence, and crime scenes. Initially, the Yemenis told them that since both of the bombers were dead, there was nothing to investigate. "But who gave them money?" Soufan asked. "Who provided the explosives? The boat?" He gently prodded the Yemenis to help him. O'Neill kept Soufan constantly at his side. Once, when he was talking to an obstructionist colonel in Yemen intelligence, O'Neill exclaimed in frustration, "Christ, this is like pulling teeth." The colonel's personal translator repeated the remark in Arabic, and the officer leaped up, visibly angry. "What'd I say?" O'Neill asked Soufan. Soufan replied that the translator had told the colonel, "If you don't answer my questions, I'm going to pull your teeth." A few days after the bombing, the Yemenis brought in two known associates of bin Laden's for questioning, Jamal Bedawi and Fahd al-Kuso. They admitted to the Yemeni authorities that they had recently traveled to Afghanistan and had met there with a one-legged jihadi named Khalad. Bedawi said that he had bought a boat for Khalad, who he explained had wanted to go into the fishing business. The Yemenis determined that this was the boat used in the Kohl bombing. When Soufan learned that the men had mentioned Khalad, he was startled. He had heard the unusual name from a source he had recruited previously in Afghanistan. The source had told him that he had met a fighter in Kandahar with a metal leg, who was one of bin Laden's top lieutenants. When Soufan asked to speak to Kuso and Bedawi, the Yemenis told him that the men had sworn on a Quran that they were innocent of any crime. For them, that settled the matter. Soufan and O'Neill knew that General Kamish represented their best hope of gaining any cooperation. He was a small, gaunt man whose face reminded Soufan of Gandhi's. Despite the tensions between the two sides, Kamish had begun calling his American colleagues Brother John and Brother Ali. O'Neill and Soufan spent long hours asking Kamish for passport photographs of suspected plotters, especially Khalad. They pointed out that the sooner they could interrogate suspects linked to the Kohl bombing, the sooner they might obtain intelligence that could destroy Al-Qaeda, while Kamish took the position that the FBI was not needed on this case. Then, one night, Kamish simply announced, "I have your photos for you." Sufan immediately sent Khalad's photo to the CIA. He also faxed it to an FBI agent in Islamabad, Pakistan. The agent showed it to Sufan's source in Afghanistan, who identified the man as Khalad, the Al-Qaeda lieutenant. It was the first tentative link connecting Al-Qaeda to the Cole attack. Another break came that same evening, when a 12-year-old boy named Hani went to the local police. He said that he had been fishing on a pier when the bombers placed their skiff in the water. One of the men had paid the boy 100 Yemeni rials, about 60 cents, to watch his Nissan truck and boat trailer. But he never returned. When the police heard Hani's story, they locked him in jail to make sure he didn't disappear and arrested his father as well. "If this is how they treat their cooperating witnesses," O'Neill observed, "imagine how they treat the more difficult ones." After repeated requests, the Americans got permission to interview the boy and to examine the launch site. Hani was scared, but he provided a description of the bombers. One was heavy, and the other was handsome. He said that the bombers had invited him and his family to take a ride in the boat, which was white, with red carpeting on the floor. When Sufan heard this, he deduced that the bombers had been trying to determine how much weight the skiff could carry. The abandoned truck and trailer were still at the launch site. It was a major mistake on the part of Al-Qaeda not to have retrieved them. By checking registration records, investigators connected the truck and trailer to a house in a neighborhood of Al-Buraika. When Sufan went to the house, which was surrounded by a wall and a gate, he had an eerie feeling. This residence had a striking resemblance to the house in Nairobi, where the bomb for the 1998 embassy attack had been made. Inside, in the master bedroom, there was a prayer rug oriented to the north, toward Mecca. The bathroom sink was full of body hair. The bombers had shaved and performed ritual ablutions before going to their deaths. Sufan's men collected a razor and hair samples, which might provide the FBI with the DNA evidence necessary to establish the identity of the killers. Investigators found another house in Aden that had been rented by the terrorists. It was registered to Abda Hussein Muhammad. The name was dimly familiar to Sufan. At one point during the Nairobi investigation, a witness had mentioned an Al-Qaeda operative named Nashiri, who had proposed attacking an American vessel in Aden. Sufan did some research and discovered that Nashiri's full name was Abdul Rahim Muhammad Hussein Abda al-Nashiri. The middle names were the same, just reversed. Sufan's hunch paid off when American agents discovered a car in Aden that was registered to Nashiri. The connections between Al-Qaeda and the Cole attack were mounting up. A couple of weeks after the bombing, Yemeni authorities placed Bedawi and Kuso, the two Al-Qaeda operatives, under arrest, apparently as a precaution. Sufan continued to press General Kamish to let him interrogate the men directly, and finally, after several weeks, Kamish relented. Sufan spent hours preparing for the encounters, with the goal of finding some common ground with the suspects. Often the bond centered on religion. Sufan was more familiar with the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet than the two operatives, and was able to shake their rationalizations about the crimes. In the interrogation of Bedawi, Sufan learned that the skiff had been purchased in Saudi Arabia. Sufan questioned Kuso over the course of several days. Kuso was small, wiry, and insolent, with a wispy beard that he kept tugging on. Before Sufan could even begin, a local intelligence official came into the room and kissed Kuso on both cheeks, a blatant signal that Kuso was protected. Whenever it seemed that Kuso was on the verge of making an important disclosure, the Yemeni colonel would insist that the session stop for meals or prayers. Eventually, however, Sufan wore Kuso down. He said he had been in Afghanistan and boasted that he had fought beside bin Laden, who inspired him with his speeches about expelling the infidels from the Arabian Peninsula. In particular, American troops stationed in Saudi Arabia. Sufan asked if Kuso ever planned to get married. A shy, embarrassed smile appeared. "Well then, help yourself out," Sufan urged him. "Tell me something." Kuso admitted that he was supposed to film the Cole bombing, but had overslept. He also disclosed that several months before the attack, he and one of the bombers had delivered $36,000 to Khalad, the one-legged Al-Qaeda lieutenant, in Bangkok. The money, Kuso added, was meant only to buy Khalad a new prosthesis. Sufan was suspicious of this explanation. Why had Al-Qaeda sent money out of Yemen just before the Cole bombing took place? Money always flowed toward an operation, not away from it. He wondered if Al-Qaeda had a bigger plot in the works. In November 2000, a month after the Cole bombing, Sufan sent the CIA the first of several official queries. On Sufan's behalf, the director of the FBI sent a letter to the director of the CIA formally requesting information about Khalad and whether there might have been an Al-Qaeda meeting somewhere in Southeast Asia before the bombing. The agency said that it had nothing. Sufan trusted this response. He thought that he had a good working relationship with the agency. Kuso had told Sufan that when he went to Bangkok to meet Khalad, they had stayed in the Washington Hotel. FBI agents went through phone records to verify his story. They found calls between the hotel and Kuso's house in Yemen. They also noticed that there were calls to both places from a payphone in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. In April 2001, Sufan sent another official teletype to the CIA, along with the passport photo of Khalad. He asked whether the telephone numbers had any significance and whether there was any connection between the numbers and Khalad. Again, the CIA said that it could not help him. In fact, the CIA knew a lot about Khalad and his ties to Al-Qaeda. The FBI and the CIA have long quarreled over bureaucratic turf, and their mandates place them at odds. The ultimate goal of the Bureau in gathering intelligence is to gain convictions for crimes. For the agency, intelligence itself is the object. If the agency had responded candidly to Sufan's requests, it would have revealed its knowledge of an Al-Qaeda cell that was already forming inside the United States. But the agency kept this intelligence to itself, an action that by itself amounted to obstruction of justice in the death of 17 American sailors. Much more tragic consequences were on the horizon. As the FBI had become more involved in international law enforcement, it was increasingly encroaching on territory that the CIA jealously protected. At the same time, the agency often benefited from the Bureau's investigations. In 1998, for instance, FBI investigators found an essential clue: a phone number in Yemen that functioned as a virtual switchboard for the terror network. The bombers in East Africa called that number before and after the attacks. So did Osama bin Laden. The number belonged to a jihadi named Ahmed Al-Hada. By combing through the records of all the calls made to and from that number, FBI investigators constructed a map of Al-Qaeda's global organization. The phone line was monitored as soon as it was discovered. But the CIA, as the primary organization for gathering foreign intelligence, had jurisdiction over conversations on the Hada phone and did not provide the FBI with the information it was getting about Al-Qaeda's plans. A conversation on the Hada phone at the end of 1999 mentioned a forthcoming meeting of Al-Qaeda operatives in Malaysia. The CIA learned the name of one participant, Khaled Al-Midar, and the first name of another, Nawaf. Both men were Saudi citizens. The CIA did not pass this intelligence to the FBI. However, the CIA did share the information with Saudi authorities, who told the agency that Midar and a man named Nawaf Al-Hazmi were members of Al-Qaeda. On the basis of this intelligence, the CIA broke into a hotel room in Dubai where Midar was spending the night en route to Malaysia. The operatives photocopied Midar's passport and faxed it to Alex Station, the CIA unit devoted to tracking bin Laden. Inside the passport was the critical information that Midar had a U.S. visa. The agency did not alert the FBI or the State Department, so that Midar's name would be put on a terror watch list, which would have prevented him from entering the United States. The CIA asked Malaysian authorities to provide surveillance of the meeting in Kuala Lumpur, the same meeting that the agency had denied knowing about in response to Sufan's official request. The gathering took place on January 5, 2000, at a condominium overlooking a golf course designed by Jack Nicklaus. The condo was owned by a Malaysian businessman who had ties to Al-Qaeda. The payphone that Sufan had queried the agency about was directly in front of the condo. Khalid used it to place calls to Kuso in Yemen. Although the CIA later denied that it knew anything about the phone, the number was recorded in the Malaysians' surveillance log, which was given to the agency. Special Branch, the Malaysian Secret Service, also photographed about a dozen Al-Qaeda associates outside the condo and visiting nearby internet cafes. These pictures were turned over to the CIA. The meeting was not wiretapped. Had it been, the agency might have uncovered the plots that culminated in the bombing of the Cole and the September 11, 2001 attacks. On January 8th, Special Branch notified the CIA that three of the men who had been at the meeting, Midar, Hazmi, and Khalid, were traveling together to Bangkok. There, Khalid met with Kuso and one of the suicide bombers of the Cole. Kuso gave Khalid the $36,000, which was most likely used to buy tickets to Los Angeles for Midar and Hazmi and provide them with living expenses in the United States. Both men ended up on planes involved in the September 11th attacks. In March, the CIA learned that Hazmi had flown to Los Angeles 2 months earlier, on January 15th. If the agency checked the flight manifest, it would have noticed that Midar was traveling with him. Once again, the agency neglected to inform the FBI or the State Department that at least one Al-Qaeda operative was in the country. Although the CIA was legally bound to share this kind of information with the Bureau, it was ferociously protective of sensitive intelligence. The agency feared that FBI prosecutions resulting from such intelligence might compromise its relationships with foreign services, although there were safeguards to protect confidential information. The CIA was particularly wary of O'Neill, who demanded control of any case that touched on an FBI investigation. Many CIA officials disliked him and feared that he could not be trusted with sensitive intelligence. O'Neill was duplicitous. Michael Scheuer, the former CIA official who founded Alex Station, told me. He had no concerns outside of making the Bureau look good. In testimony before a congressional committee on April 17, 2007, Scheuer was questioned about his relationship with O'Neill, and he responded, "The only good thing that happened to America on 9/11 was that the building fell on him, sir." The CIA may also have been protecting an overseas operation and was afraid that the FBI would expose it. Moreover, Midhar and Hazmi might have seemed like attractive recruitment possibilities. The CIA was desperate for a source inside Al-Qaeda. Having failed to penetrate the inner circle or even to place someone in the training camps, even though they were basically open to anyone who showed up. However, once Midhar and Hazmi entered the United States, they were within the province of the FBI. The CIA has no legal authority to operate inside the country. Because of Midhar and Hazmi's connection to bin Laden, who had a federal indictment against him, the FBI had all the authority it needed to use every investigative technique to penetrate and disrupt the Al-Qaeda cell. Instead, the hijackers were free to develop their plot until it was too late to stop them. In Yemen, the security situation deteriorated rapidly. Safwan and the other FBI agents were quartered at the Aden Hotel, crammed in with other U.S. military and government employees, including Marine guards, billeted 3 and 4 to a room. Several dozen slept on bedrolls in the hotel ballroom. Gunfire frequently erupted outside the hotel. It wasn't clear that the Yemeni government troops who were guarding the hotel from machine gun nests would truly protect the Americans. "We were prisoners," an agent recalled. One night, shots were fired on the street nearby while O'Neill was running a meeting inside the hotel. The Marines and the hostage rescue team adopted defensive positions. Safwan ventured out, unarmed, to talk to the Yemeni troops.
"Hey, Ali,"
O'Neill called out.
"Be careful."
He raced down the steps of the hotel to make sure Safwan was wearing his flak jacket. Frustration, stress, and danger, along with the enforced intimacy of their situation, had brought the two men even closer. O'Neill had begun to describe Safwan as his secret weapon. Speaking to the Yemenis, he called him simply, "My son." Snipers covered Safwan as he approached a Yemeni officer who assured him that everything was okay.
"If everything is okay, why are there no cars on the street?" Safwan asked.
The officer said that there must be a wedding nearby. Safwan looked around and saw that the hotel was surrounded by a large number of men in traditional dress, some in jeeps, all carrying guns. They were civilians, not soldiers. They could be intelligence officers or a tribal group bent on revenge. In either case, they easily outnumbered the Americans. Safwan was reminded of the 1993 uprising in Somalia, which ended with 18 American soldiers dead and one of the bodies being dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. He noted that the Aden Hotel backed up to the harbor, and the Americans were essentially trapped. After Safwan went inside and offered his assessment of the situation, O'Neill ordered the Marines to deploy 2 armored vehicles to block the street in front of the hotel. The night passed without further incident, but the next day O'Neill moved the investigators to the USS Duluth, stationed 10 miles away in the Bay of Aden. That proved to be a dangerous mistake. The next morning, when O'Neill and Safwan were flying back to town, The helicopter suddenly lurched into violent evasive maneuvers. The pilot reported that an SA-7 missile had locked in on them. O'Neill decided to send most of the investigators home. Those who remained returned to the deserted hotel. Just before Thanksgiving, the FBI pulled O'Neill out of Yemen, apparently as a concession to Ambassador Bodine, who felt that the conspicuous FBI presence was straining diplomatic relations between America and Yemen. Soufan stayed on, but the threats in Aden became so acute that he and the other agents moved to the American embassy in Sana'a, Yemen's capital. The investigation was losing its momentum. In the late spring of 2001, Tom Wilshire, a CIA liaison at FBI headquarters in Washington, was studying the relationship between Khaled al-Midhar, the Saudi al-Qaeda operative, and Khalad, the one-legged jihadi. Because of the similarity of the names, the CIA had thought that they might be the same person. But thanks to Ali Soufan's investigations in Yemen, the agency now knew that they were not, and that Khalad had orchestrated the coal attack.
"Okay, this is important," Wilshire said of Khalad in an email to his supervisors at the CIA Counterterrorism Center on July 13th. "This is a major league killer." Wilshire already knew that Hazmi, the other Saudi operative, had arrived in the United States, and that Midhar was possibly with him. "Something bad is definitely up," Wilshire wrote to a colleague. He asked permission to disclose this vital information to the FBI. His superiors at the CIA never responded to his request. Wilshire asked an FBI analyst to review the material on the Malaysia meeting, but he did not reveal that some of the participants might be in the United States. More important, he conveyed none of the urgency reflected in his email. He told the analyst that she should examine the material in her free time. She didn't get around to it until the end of July. Wilshire did want to know, however, what the FBI knew. He provided Dina Corsi, another FBI analyst, with three surveillance photos from the Malaysia meeting to several agents on the I-49 squad, the group responsible for counterterrorism. The pictures showed Midhar and Hazmi, and a man who the CIA believed resembled Kuso, the failed coal cameraman. Wilshire told Corsi that one of the men was named Khaled al-Midhar, but he did not explain why the pictures had been taken, and he did not mention that Midhar had a U.S. visa. On June 11th, Clark Shannon, a CIA supervisor, went with Corsi to New York to meet with FBI case agents on the coal investigation. Soufan was still in Yemen. The meeting started in mid-morning, with the New York agents briefing Shannon and Corsi for 3 or 4 hours on the progress of their investigation. Corsi then displayed the three Malaysia photographs for her FBI colleagues. They were high-quality surveillance photos. One, shot from a low angle, showed Midhar and Hazmi standing beside a tree. Shannon wanted to know if the agents recognized anyone. The I-49 agents asked who was in the pictures, and when and where they had been taken. "Were there any other photographs of this meeting?" one of the FBI agents demanded. Shannon refused to say. Corsi promised that, in the days and weeks to come, she would try to get permission to pass that information along. The meeting became heated. The FBI agents sensed that these photographs pertained directly to crimes they were trying to solve, but they couldn't elicit any further information from Shannon. Corsi finally dropped the name Khaled al-Midhar. Steve Bongart, Soufan's top assistant in the coal investigation, asked Shannon to provide a date of birth or a passport number to go with Midhar's name. A name by itself was not sufficient to prevent his entry into the United States. Bongart had just returned from Pakistan with a list of 30 names of suspected al-Qaeda associates and their dates of birth, which he had given to the State Department. That was standard procedure, the first thing most investigators would do. But Shannon declined to provide the additional information. Top CIA officials had not authorized him to disclose the vital details of Midhar's U.S. visa, his association with Hazmi, and their affiliation with Khalad and al-Qaeda. The CIA's own inspector general would discover that as many as 50 to 60 individuals in the agency had read cables relating the presence of al-Qaeda operatives in America. There was a fourth photograph of the Malaysia meeting that Shannon did not produce. That was a picture of Khalad, the one-legged operative. Thanks to Sufan's interrogation of Kuso, the Cole investigators had an active file on Khalad and were preparing to indict him. Knowledge of that fourth photo would likely have prompted O'Neill to demand that the CIA turn over all information relating to Khalad and his associates. The al-Qaeda summit meeting in Kuala Lumpur would have been revealed, as would the names of the al-Qaeda operatives already in America. By withholding the picture of Khalad attending the meeting with the future hijackers, the CIA may have allowed the September 11th plot to proceed. That summer, Midhar returned to Yemen and then went to Saudi Arabia, where he presumably helped the remaining hijackers secure entry into the United States. He also received yet another American visa from the consulate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Since the CIA had not given his name to the State Department to post on its watch list, Midhar arrived in New York on the 4th of July. The June 11th meeting was the culmination of a strange trend in the U.S. government toward hiding information from the people who most needed it. In this regard, the FBI was as guilty as the CIA. A federal law at the time prohibited the sharing of information arising from grand jury testimony, but the FBI took it as a nearly absolute bar to revealing any investigative evidence, and as a result, repeatedly turned down requests for information from other intelligence agencies. In 1995, the Justice Department established a policy known as the Wall, which regulated the exchange of foreign intelligence information between agents and criminal investigators. Managers at FBI headquarters turned it into a straitjacket for their own investigators. Intelligence agents in the Bureau were warned that sharing such information with criminal agents could mean the end of their careers. The Wall even separated people who were on the same squad. The FBI also began withholding intelligence from the White House. Every morning on the classified computers of the National Security Council, there were at least 100 reports from the CIA, the NSA, and other intelligence branches. But the FBI never disseminated information. The CIA frequently decided to shield intelligence from the FBI on the grounds that it would compromise sensitive sources and methods. The NSA also jealously withheld intelligence, collecting crucial information about Midhar, for instance, that it did not provide to the FBI. Midhar, it turned out, was the son-in-law of Ahmed al-Hada, the al-Qaeda loyalist in Yemen whose phone number operated as the network's switchboard. In San Diego, Midhar made at least 8 calls to the Hada phone to talk to his wife, who was about to give birth. Those calls were not shared with the FBI, even though the calls made to and from that phone provided the basis for the Bureau's worldwide map of al-Qaeda. In the I-49 squad's office, there was a link chart drawing connections between Hada's phone and other phones around the globe. had a line been drawn from Hada's Yemen home to Midhar's San Diego apartment 8 times, Al-Qaeda's presence in America would have been glaringly obvious. Michael Scheuer, the former head of Alex Station, told journalist James Bamford that the NSA also failed to distribute this information to the CIA as well, forcing the agency to build its own collection capability. Missed calls, foreign policy. After September 11th, the CIA claimed that it had divulged Midhar's identity to the FBI in a timely manner. Indeed, both George Tenet, the agency's director, and Kofor Black, the head of its counterterrorism center, testified to Congress that this was the case. Later, the 9/11 Commission concluded that the statements of both were false. The CIA was unable to produce any evidence proving that the information had been passed to the Bureau. The I-49 squad responded to the secrecy in aggressive and creative ways. When the CIA refused to share intercepts of bin Laden's satellite phone, the squad came up with a plan to build 2 antennae to capture the signal. One on Palau in the Pacific, and another on Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. The squad also constructed an ingenious satellite telephone booth in Kandahar, hoping to provide a convenient facility for jihadis wanting to call home. The agents listened in on the calls, and they received videos of callers through a camera hidden in the booth. Millions of dollars and thousands of hours of labor were consumed in replicating information that other U.S. officials already had, but refused to share. According to Sufan, the I-49 agents were so used to being denied access to intelligence that they bought a CD containing the Pink Floyd song, Another Brick in the Wall. He recalled, "Whenever we got the speech about sensitive sources and methods, we'd just hold up the phone to the CD player and push play." Just days before the June 11th meeting took place in the New York office, new threats in Yemen created a security crisis for the Americans. Yemeni authorities arrested 8 men who they said were part of a plot to blow up the American embassy, where Sufan and other investigators had taken refuge. Louis Free, the director of the FBI, acting on O'Neill's recommendation, withdrew the team entirely. By then, Sufan had a much clearer idea of the relationship between Khalad and the Kohl conspirators. In July 2001, he sent a 3rd formal request to the CIA asking for information about a possible Al-Qaeda meeting in Malaysia and about Khalad's trip to Bangkok to meet with Kuso and the Kohl suicide bomber. Yet again, the agency did not respond. On August 22nd, John O'Neill was packing boxes in his office on his last day at the FBI. He had decided to retire from the Bureau after the Times reported that his briefcase, containing sensitive documents, was stolen while he was attending an FBI conference in Florida. Although the briefcase was quickly recovered, and it was determined that none of the sensitive material had been touched, it had ruined his prospects at the Bureau. That day, Sufan came by O'Neill's office to say goodbye. He was returning to Yemen later that afternoon. O'Neill's last act as an FBI agent was to sign the paperwork that would send Sufan's team back into the country. They were determined to arrest the killers of the American sailors, despite the risks of working in such a hostile environment. The two men walked to a nearby diner. O'Neill ordered a ham and cheese sandwich. "You don't want to change your infidel ways," Sufan kidded him, indicating the ham. "You're going to go to hell." O'Neill urged Sufan to visit him at the World Trade Center, where he had taken a job as head of security. "I'm going to be just down the road," he said. Sufan confided that he and his longtime girlfriend had decided to get married. O'Neill gave his blessing. "She's put up with you all this time," he joked. "She must be a good woman."
The week that O'Neill retired from the bureau, the FBI analyst at Alex Station, who had been reviewing intelligence on the Malaysia meeting, realized that Midhar and Hazmi were in the United States. She passed the information to Dina Corsi at FBI headquarters. Corsi, alarmed, sent an email to the supervisor of the I-49 squad, ordering the unit to locate the Al-Qaeda operatives. But, she added, because of the wall, no criminal investigators could be involved in the search. As it turned out, there was only one intelligence agent available, and he was new. An FBI agent forwarded Corsi's message to Steve Bongart, Sufan's top assistant. He called her.
"Dina, you gotta be kidding me," he said. "Midhar's in the country?"
He complained that the wall was a bureaucratic fiction that was preventing investigators from doing their work. In a conversation the next day, he said,
"If this guy is in the country, it's not because he's going to fucking Disneyland."
Later, he wrote in an email,
"Someday, somebody will die. And, wall or not, the public will not understand why we were not more effective."
The rookie agent's attempt to find Midhar and Hazmi proved fruitless. 3 weeks later, on September 11th, 2001, Sufan was at the embassy in Sana'a. He spoke on the phone with his fiancée, who told him that the Twin Towers had been attacked. He turned on a television and watched as the second plane hit. He called O'Neill's cell phone repeatedly, but there was no answer. The FBI ordered Sufan and the rest of his team in Yemen to evacuate. The morning of September 12th, the CIA's chief of station in Aden escorted the agents to the airport in Sana'a. The CIA official was sitting in the lounge with Sufan when he got a call on his cell phone from FBI headquarters. He told Sufan, "They want to talk to you." Dina Corsi spoke to Sufan and ordered him to stay in Yemen. He was upset. He wanted to return to New York and investigate the attack on America.
"This is about that. What happened yesterday?"
she told him. "Kuso is our only lead." She wouldn't tell him any more. Sufan got his luggage off the plane, but he was puzzled. What did Kuso, the sleeping coal cameraman, have to do with September 11th? Robert McFadden, a naval investigator who speaks Arabic, and a couple of SWAT guys stayed behind to help Sufan, along with a small team of FBI agents. The order from headquarters was to identify the September 11th hijackers by any means necessary, a directive that Sufan had never seen before. When he returned to the embassy, a fax containing photographs of 20 suspects came over a secure line. Then the CIA chief drew Sufan aside and handed him a manila envelope. Inside were three surveillance photographs and a complete report about the Malaysia meeting, the very material that he had asked for so many times. The wall had come down. When Sufan realized that the CIA had known for more than a year and a half that two of the hijackers were in the country, he ran into the bathroom and threw up. Sufan went to General Kamish's office and demanded to see Kuso again. "What does this have to do with the coal?" Kamish wanted to know.
"I'm not talking about the coal," said Sufan.
"Brother John is missing." He started to say something else, but he was unable to continue. General Kamish's eyes also filled with tears.
"Kamish instantly made a decision," McFadden recalls. "He said, 'You tell me what you want and I'll make it happen.'"
Kamish said that Kuso was in Aden and there was one last flight that evening from there to the capital.
He called his subordinates on the phone and began shouting,
I want Kuso flown in here tonight.
Then the general called the airport and demanded to be patched through to the pilot.
You will not take off until my prisoner is aboard, he ordered.
At midnight, in a room not far from Kamish's office, Sufan met with Kuso, who was in a petulant frame of mind.
Just because something happens in New York or Washington, you don't need to talk to me, he said.
Sufan showed him the three surveillance photographs of the Malaysia meeting, which included the Saudi hijackers, Midhar, and Hazmi. Kuso thought he remembered seeing them in Al-Qaeda camps, but he wasn't certain.
Why are you asking about them?
He wanted to know. He denied being in any of the photos. Finally, the next day, the CIA passed along the fourth photograph of the Malaysia meeting. The picture of Khalad, the mastermind of the coal operation. The two plots, Sufan instantly realized, were linked. And if the CIA had not withheld information from him, he likely would have drawn the connection months before September 11th. He met again with Kuso, who identified the figure in the picture as Khalad. The first confirmation of Al-Qaeda's responsibility for the September 11th attacks. Sufan interrogated Kuso for 3 nights, while during the day he wrote reports and did research, sleeping little more than an hour at a time.
He was sick as a dog, but he was getting really good information, his fellow agent Carlos Fernandez recalled.
On the fourth night, Sufan collapsed from exhaustion.
We wanted to medevac him out of there, Fernandez said. We took him to the emergency room. The kid could barely stand, but he refused to leave. And the next day, he was right back at it. None of us had ever seen anything like that. His co-workers began referring to Sufan as an American hero.
Sufan was intensely aware that the information he was getting was critical, and that perhaps no one else could extract the truth from Kuso. Finally, after hours of extended questioning, Kuso was shown a photograph of Marwan al-Shehhi, the hijacker who piloted United Airlines Flight 175, which crashed into the second tower. Kuso identified him and said that he had met Shehhi in a guest house in Kandahar. He remembered that Shehhi had been ill during Ramadan and that the emir, or chief, of the guest house had taken care of him. The emir's name was Abu Jandal. As it happened, Abu Jandal was also in Yemeni custody, and the Americans arranged to interview him. He was a large, powerful man with a dark beard.
What are these infidels doing here? He demanded.
He took a plastic chair and turned it around, sitting with his arms crossed and his back to the interrogators. After some coaxing, Sufan got Abu Jandal to face him, but he refused to look him in the eye. Abu Jandal did want to talk, however. He delivered a lengthy, rapid-fire rant against America. Sufan realized that the prisoner was trained in counter-interrogation techniques, since he easily agreed to things that Sufan already knew, that he had fought in Bosnia, Somalia, and Afghanistan, for instance, and denied everything else. Abu Jandal portrayed himself as a good Muslim who had considered jihad, but had become disillusioned. He thought of himself not as a killer, but as a revolutionary who was trying to rid the world of evil, which he believed came mainly from the United States, a country he knew practically nothing about. As the nights passed, Abu Jandal warmed to Sufan. He was in his early 30s, older than most jihadis. He had grown up in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, bin Laden's hometown, and he was well-read in religion. He seemed to enjoy drinking tea and lecturing the Americans on the radical Islamist view of history. Sociability was his weak spot.
Sufan flattered him and engaged him in theological debate. Listening to Abu Jandal's diatribes, Sufan picked up several useful details. That he had grown tired of fighting, that he was troubled by the fact that bin Laden had sworn loyalty to Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and that he worried about his two children, one of whom had a bone disease. Sufan also noted that Abu Jandal declined some pastries because he was a diabetic. The next night, Sufan brought some sugarless wafers, a courtesy that Abu Jandal acknowledged. Sufan also brought him a history of America in Arabic. Abu Jandal was confounded by Sufan, a moderate Muslim who could argue about Islam with him, who was in the FBI, and who loved America. He quickly read the history that Sufan gave him and was amazed to learn of the American Revolution and its struggle against tyranny. Sufan, meanwhile, was trying to determine the boundaries of Abu Jandal's moral landscape. He inquired about the proper way to wage jihad. Abu Jandal eagerly talked about how a warrior should treat his adversary in battle. The Quran and other Islamic texts discuss the ethics of conduct in warfare. Where do they sanction suicide bombing? Sufan asked him. Abu Jandal said that the enemy had an advantage in weapons, but the suicide bombers evened the score.
These are our missiles, he said.
What about women and children? Sufan asked. Aren't they supposed to be protected? Sufan pointed to the bombings of the American embassies in East Africa. He recalled a woman on a bus in front of the Nairobi embassy who, after the bomb exploded, was found clutching her baby, trying to protect him from the flames. Both had been incinerated. What sin had the mother committed? What about the soul of her child?
God will give them their rewards in the hereafter, Abu Jandal said. Besides, he added, can you imagine how many joined bin Laden after the embassy bombings? Hundreds came and asked to be martyrs.
Sufan countered that many of the East African victims, perhaps most of them, were Muslims. Several times, Abu Jandal quoted clerical authorities or chapters from the Quran, but he found that Sufan was more than a match for him on theological matters. Abu Jandal finally asserted that because the embassy bombings were on a Friday, when the victims should have been in the mosque, they were not real Muslims. On the fifth night, Sufan slammed a news magazine on the table between them. The magazine had photographs of the airplanes crashing into the Twin Towers. Graphic shots of people trapped in the buildings and jumping 100 stories.
Bin Laden did this,
Sufan told him. Abu Jandal had heard about the attacks, but he didn't know many details. He studied the pictures in amazement. He said that they looked like a Hollywood production, but the scale of the atrocity visibly shook him. McFadden and 2 Yemeni investigators joined Sufan and Abu Jandal in the small interrogation room. Everyone sensed that Sufan was closing in. American and allied troops were preparing to go to war in Afghanistan, but they desperately needed more information about the structure of Al-Qaeda, the locations of hideouts, and the plans for escape, all of which American intelligence officials hoped Abu Jandal could supply. Coincidentally, a local Yemeni paper was on a shelf under the coffee table. Sufan showed it to Abu Jandal. The headline read, 200 Yemeni souls perish in New York attack. At the time, the death toll estimates were in the tens of thousands. Abu Jandal read the headline and drew a breath.
God help us,
he muttered. Sufan asked what kind of Muslim would do such a thing. Abu Jandal insisted that the Israelis must have committed the attacks on New York and Washington.
The Sheikh is not that crazy, he said of bin Laden.
Sufan then took out a book of mugshots containing photographs of known al-Qaeda members and of the hijackers. He asked Abu Jandal to identify them. The Yemeni flipped through them quickly and closed the book. Sufan opened the book again and told him to take his time.
Some of them I have in custody, he said,
hoping that Abu Jandal wouldn't realize that the hijackers were all dead. Abu Jandal paused for a half second on the photograph of Shehi, the pilot of United Airlines Flight 175, before he started to turn the page.
You're not done with this one, Sufan said. Ramadan, 1999. He's sick. You're his emir and you take care of him.
Abu Jandal looked at Sufan in shock.
When I ask you a question, I already know the answer, said Sufan. If you're smart, you'll tell me the truth.
Abu Jandal conceded that he knew Shehi and gave his al-Qaeda nom de guerre, Abdullah al-Sharqi. He did the same with Khalid al-Midar and five others, including Muhammad Atta, the lead hijacker. But he still insisted that bin Laden would never commit such an action. It was the Israelis, he maintained.
I know for sure that the people who did this were al-Qaeda guys, said Sufan.
He took seven photographs out of the book and laid them on the table.
How do you know?
Abu Jandal asked.
Who told you?
You did, said Sufan. These are the hijackers. You just identified them. Abu Jandal turned pale. He covered his face with his hands.
Give me a moment, he pleaded.
Sufan walked out of the room. When he came back, he asked Abu Jandal what he thought now.
I think the Sheikh went crazy, he said.
And then he told Sufan everything he knew. Postscript. Ali Sufan played an important role in debunking the CIA's assertions about the usefulness and effectiveness of torture. I interviewed him for my 2010 documentary, My Trip to Al-Qaeda, directed by Alex Gibney, when he was still undercover, and he spoke about how he refused to participate in what the agency termed enhanced interrogation techniques. In fact, he considered placing the interrogators under arrest before the FBI decided that it could no longer be a part of such procedures. Sufan retired from the FBI in 2005 and is the founder of the Sufan Group, an international security and intelligence organization.